Welcome, everyone, to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in Northwest Lower Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. During the next hour, I will chat with the winners of the 2009 Michigan Writers Cooperative Press, Teresa Scullin, Jamie Delp, and Jenny Robertson. Then I will talk with fiction writer and poet Julia Case. And at the end, poet Fleeta Brown will provide us with a thoughtful commentary. I would like to welcome Teresa Scullin, Jamie Delp, and Jenny Robertson to Michigan Writers on the Air. And joining me for this conversation is Anne Marie Oman, the president of Michigan Writers.
Welcome all.
Thank you.
Anne Marie, let's start with you. Tell us about the Cooperative Press. How did it start? What's the submission process? And how are the winning manuscripts selected?
Okay.
And what's a chapbook?
Well, the Cooperative Press started out of our survey several years ago now on what our members really wanted. And one of several things that became priorities was the need to create some venue or means for publishing that would be legitimate and would create a means for us to recognize some of the wonderful writing that was going on. And so the Cooperative Press came out of that, and it's kind of a new world idea in that we do not act as a formal publisher, but we act as a press in cooperation with the author. And I think that makes us pretty special. There are only a couple of others in the country.
Last I checked, there are no others.
There are no other
at the moment. There used to be.
Wow, that's pretty cool. We're in our fourth year now?
There's one in Canada, but we're the only ones in the U.S.
Thank you. I didn't have that information. But part of this came out of this idea of both the author and the supporting organization taking responsibility for the publication process. So what we do is we hold a contest. Our writers submit. Any member can submit, and you can become a member and submit. And then the screening committee reads the manuscripts. There's an adjudication process.
Now, this year, how many manuscripts did we receive?
I think close to 30.
Close to 30.
Yes. I think, and they were divided between poetry and prose.
Yes.
And then the screening committee ranks them.
Okay. Before we get to that stage, though, they're read blind. What does that mean?
Yes, read blind means that there are no identifying marks on any of the pages, which means that we don't know who the authors are.
And if any of the judges see a manuscript that looks familiar, they must recuse themselves.
Yes, that is correct. They have to, and somebody else has to read and respond to that manuscript. And that keeps the adjudication process objective.
Yes.
And we like that very much. So that process is in place, and then after they're adjudicated and the ones that are selected come to the surface, then we begin actually a revision process, because the whole purpose of this was to help emerging writers and to really identify people in the region, in the Great Lakes area, that were really starting to do good work but hadn't yet had a book published.
Okay.
And so these are people who are new writers, and not necessarily new writers, but developing their publishing history, basically. And so we work with them on a feedback system where they are given lots of information about what the screeners thought. We usually have a meeting with them and talk it through. Then they go away, and they have the opportunity then to shift in any way they want to the manuscript, or take the advice or not take the advice, or take part of the advice and come back with a new document, or a slightly altered document, hopefully much improved. But
well, why don't we stop for a second and ask our three chapbook writers, how did you change in the process of revision, or how did your books change?
I thought that the
the comments were very helpful in...
And this is Teresa speaking.
Yes, I am Teresa. The comments were very interesting to me, and they helped me understand how my book was read by others. Because when you're writing it yourself, you get so attached to it and your vision for it that you don't necessarily know how it will be seen.
Yeah, I'm often knocked over by my own stunning prose until someone else
until someone else has the presence of mind to comment on it. So those comments were very helpful, and it actually, I did some changing and some changes I decided not to make. But ultimately what ended up happening is I became much more clear about what it was that I was writing and what my vision for the material was. And so those comments were helpful to me, even though I didn't adopt all of them. Mm-hmm. They were all helpful in helping me define what is it that I'm trying to do here and what is the vision for this work that I want to commit to. So I came out of that whole revision process feeling much more centered in what it was I was trying to accomplish.
Good. Mm-hmm. Jamie? Or?
Oh, I had a very similar response. It just helped me clarify so much what I was actually trying to say. And I felt that especially with some of the pieces that I had more distance from, you know, it was really kind of going back into some really early work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I'd just gotten so used to it a certain way that it was amazing to go back to some of those older pieces with some new insights and kind of bring new life to them again with some of the revisions. That was exciting for me. Yeah.
Jenny.
It was funny to me to realize what a reader sees when they read, too, because there were several things I had to change because I was given feedback that it couldn't have happened that way.
I was one of the
yeah,
people.
Yeah, I remember.
There's no way a bird can fly through a window.
And that's what I was thinking. So it had to be a different kind of bird in a not as strong of glass, you know, and it just made me realize how real the world can be of a story. And a reader needs it to be and needs it to make sense. So there were several things like that. And in places where I hadn't necessarily been clear about several different plot points coming together and needing to know where they needed to be clarified. So it was great.
Okay, so, and Michigan Writers' responsibility in this whole process?
We create the chapbook, which is, as you wanted to know earlier, a small book, usually 24 to 30 pages, somewhere in that range. It's a simple production, usually, and it's a startup book. Mm-hmm. It's considered sort of the initiation book. And they tend to be small. Sometimes they're very simply designed, but in our case, we have Heather Shaw as our designer, so they're gorgeous. They're beautiful. They're fun. They have just this beautiful custom look to them. We print 100, so it's a collector's item.
Mm-hmm.
And
100 signed copies.
That is correct. That is correct. And then there's a premiere reading, which in this case will happen on April 2nd at the Writing House on Interlochen campus.
7 p.m.?
7:30.
Yes,
7:30 p.m. And the chapbook is, it's that transition book. And so it's a really beautiful process to help an author do this first sort of notable thing. And we're really pleased to be able to participate in this. And we share the expenses. That's
and
the
we
cooperative
share the expression.
Part.
Yes. Michigan Writers pays half the cost or
yes.
a little more than half the cost and does all the in-kind work.
Yes.
The layout, the covers, the interior design, all of that work.
Yes, that is correct. And they're very lovely books.
They're gorgeous books.
They are indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when you got the phone calls, before we move into the next section, when you got the phone call or the email and heard that you had been selected, what was the response?
Well, this is Teresa again. I was delighted and I was terrified. It was instantly terrified.
Exactly.
I thought, I've been called on my bluff. And now I actually have to print these things and send them out and put my name on them. I thought about changing my name or perhaps adopting a pen name, but I'm not that organized.
People in the real world will know what really goes on in your head.
Exactly. And in the process of trying to choose work for a chapbook, I was really trying to bring together poems that spoke to each other. And so that left out some of my work. And And what I ended up with was a mix of some new poems, but a lot of older poems too. And that's a challenge too, to look at older work with a new eye and say, is this really what I think is good enough to put out into the world?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that I had to get through that fear.
Yeah.
I remember yelping something, you know, tried to put the phone a little bit away from my ear so I didn't, you know, hurt Anne Marie's ear. But then.
That's right. That was a fun call.
Yeah. And I think I would have gone completely into worry immediately, but I think you said something like, just ride that feeling for today. And I did. And it was a wonderful day.
Good advice.
Oh, I think I was downtown shopping when Anne Marie called.
Oh.
In a store, and I kind of ran out into the street and was ecstatic, and then I think all the fear set in the next day.
Yeah.
Thinking, yeah, I'm gonna be putting my name on this. Am I ready for this? But
You are. It's a wonderful manuscript. Okay, Teresa, let's start with you. Let's have some background. I know you've been writing for a while. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing this year, this is our fourth year, the interesting thing this year is two of the three chapbook authors this year are graduates of the Interlochen Arts Academy in mm-hmm. creative writing. And you were here in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
and then you went off and did other things. Tell us about what you did in the interim.
In the interim?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm a Michigan native, so I grew up in the Thumb.
The Thumb. Just think, you get to, you know, the rest of us don't get to identify quite that way. You know, I grew up in the Index, you know?
Yeah. The Thumb is a good place. But I grew up in the Thumb. I came here as a pianist, actually.
Really?
And I left as a, at that time you could have a couple of majors, and I was a piano student and also a writer. And left here and did a lot of different things. Worked in corporate America for a while, went to college and learned Japanese. So I worked in the Japanese auto industry for a brief period, got an MBA, went off into corporate America and, learned a lot, and then left, and had my own consulting business, and farmed, and just previous to coming back to Interlochen as the writer-in-residence, I was the diversity director for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So did a lot of things, tried a lot of things, and I think the common link was that I was working with people a lot. I was in the arena of human resources,
mm-hmm.
and the stories are great. I can't tell some of them ever, but the stories are wonderful. Maybe a little short story to start with. This one was told to me by a dear friend of mine who was kind enough to write a blurb on the back of the chapbook, actually. At one point, I lived in a little town, like many little towns, where it had everything. We had our own dairy, we had our own meat market, we had everything we needed in this tiny little village of 1,800 people, and it was complete civilization. It was wonderful. But there was a place called Gross's Meat Market, and this is called Halloween at Gross's Meat Market, and it features a couple of characters, Jack and Mrs. Kobernick, whose name becomes important. Halloween at Gross's Meat Market. Mrs. Kobernick came in, towing two little costumed kids. "And who do we have here?" says Jack. "Are these goblins?" "Nope," she says. "Dem's Kobernicks."
I started laughing before you started reading. Remembering that poem, I was trying to control myself.
Yeah. So some of these have been passed around and around and around. I was thinking on the way out here, how do you even talk about process? And my mom recently told me a story about that was passed to her by a drug salesman, and I'll explain that in a second. But pharmaceutical. Thank you, pharmaceutical salesman, who overheard two old timers sitting in a doctor's office, and one of them said to the other, "Well, wouldn't it be a hell of a note to live through this winter and die in the spring?" And that's not a poem yet, but it's rattling around
it's
in my
its
head.
Way.
It's on its way. And it's fascinating to me that, one, the language that is used is so interesting, and it's kind of off-center, you know, talking about two topics at once in a humorous way. But also that this story has now gone at least four steps. It's probably changed each time from the people having the conversation to the pharmaceutical salesman, to my mother, to me, and now to all of you. So I think it's very interesting how that is such a necessary impulse for people to tell a story. Maybe I'll tell you, read the title poem.
Title poem's great.
So this is this kind of gets to my idea of community too. I think everybody's here, whether you agree with them or not. And this is a story that was also told to me. Friday nights, the whole town goes to the basketball game. Oh, maybe I should back up and say the Thumb was a place where there was a lot of activity several years ago with the Michigan militia. And that sort of appeared in the kind of conversations people were having. Friday nights, the whole town goes to the basketball game. Nick said, "Listen, Bill, this is no joke. Chinese tanks. Chinese tanks, Bill, were spotted rolling up I-75. What you think you know about the United Nations is lies. Lies. Spread by an international conspiracy to take over our homeland. We've got to protect our country, protect our constitutional right to bear arms. But I'm ready. I'm ready. I've got guns and ammunition buried in my front yard. I'm warning you, you'll regret it if you don't do the same." Bill said, "Nick, Nick, what are you thinking? This is, what if the Chinese show up in February, Nick? This is Michigan, for Christ's sake. How are you going to get those guns out of your front yard when the ground is frozen? What are you going to do then, Nick?"
I remember when we were reading this manuscript, we were knocked out because it had this beautiful lyrical element, but then these absolutely humorous pieces, and it was very refreshing to, in the texture of, you know, reading all these manuscripts, to find that wit running through those poems.
And it was interesting. I was sitting in that meeting, and the people who had read the poetry manuscripts were talking about it, and one of the people said, "Yeah, I'd really like to meet this writer. I know it's a guy, and he's
really
and he's really funny."
Boy, I'm going to disappoint them on two counts. Maybe one more poem?
Oh, we have time for several more.
Okay. What interests me, too, about the humor is that it's often a way of talking about something else entirely that's not so humorous. Mm-hmm. It's much more serious. And some of those are in the chapbook, too. In the last several years, I lost my dad to cancer, and so some of these stories, not a lot of that in this chapbook, but some poems are relate to that topic as well. And this is a story that my dad told me. This is almost, a good part of this is out of his mouth. I mean, this is what he said to me. This is called "Dad Hides His Shakiness by Telling a Story." Jerry Biterman stops in every so often to see me. The other day he drove me out to the stockyards east of town for lunch and a piece of pie. They're famous for their pie, you know. They must make 20 pies a morning. They've got a gal, all she does is make the pies. And they put a huge piece on your plate. Must be a quarter pie with ice cream. It's a meal in itself. Old Jerry, he's a talker, always teasing the women. They just laugh with him. He says, "Oh, stop." They just laugh. Old Jerry tells everybody in the restaurant he had an operation on his rear end and the stitches left quite a scar. Jerry went back to the doctor and said, "I've got a vet who can sew up a cut on my horse and never leave a scar, and here you've marked me for life." I sewed up his horse once and it healed right over. Jerry's telling everybody in the place. All the old farmers are laughing. I said, "What are you doing, Jerry? Showing everybody your rear end?" Well, they all laughed at that. They said, "That's right, Jerry. What do you need to show off your rear end for?" You know, Jerry lived through cancer himself. That's what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm. How about one more?
One more?
I like the gas station one.
The gas station one.
Oh, yes.
We already have our favorites.
Okay. All right. This is a Chicago poem. I used to work for a long time for an oil company, and for a few years, all I did was teach people how to run service stations. And I worked with a guy who I called the first Bob ever, and this is a story that he told me. The first Bob ever handles a Middle East situation. Talk about your diversity. I had this gas station in New York in a Jewish neighborhood. I had a cashier, a Middle Eastern guy with a turban and a bracelet. He was good, but I didn't want the customers getting all upset about the turban. See, this was during one of those wars. This time it was bad. So I told the guy he couldn't wear the turban on the job. He said, "I'm very sorry, sir." He was real polite. "But I cannot take off my turban. It is my religion." I told him, "You can wear it at home, but on the job you have to take it off." He said, "I'm very sorry, sir. I want to keep my job, but I cannot take off my turban. I cannot uncover my head to God." "Geez, Louise." I told him, "Look, pal, it's against the uniform policy. Say what you want, but where I come from, if the company says jump, I say, how high? My boss doesn't want to hear about religion. These guys, they don't get it. They think this is some kind of family. They'd give half the merchandise in the store away. Just try and talk to them about shrink. They say, he is my brother. He is my uncle. How can I refuse him? How can you run a business like that? I say, leave your religion at home. We got enough problems. But I had to make it work. He was a good employee. He wasn't stealing. So I gave the guy a compromise. I told him to wear a blue turban to match the uniform. We stitched the company logo on the front. Everybody seemed happy. And the first thing I learned as a manager, if you fire everybody, you have to work all the shifts yourself.
Oh, that's so much fun. It's a wonderful collection.
Thank you. That's Thank just you great. Very much.
There's such a lovely wisdom in that.
Absolutely. Jenny, when I first met you, I had no idea that you were a writer. You were working in a kayak shop.
Right.
They allowed people to try out kayaks, and I spent a summer trying out every kayak you had. It was great.
That was fun.
So tell us about where you went to school and how you got started writing, and you're an artist in many ways.
Yeah, I grew up in northern Minnesota, just north of Brainerd, and that was a wonderful childhood. My parents were both very encouraging of all things artistic, you know, painting and reading and writing, and they put up with the skits and plays and songs and stories that we subjected them to. It made them pay to see, actually, as children. So
we will do anything to get our kids to flourish.
And I ended up going to college at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. And at that point, I really was quite certain I was meant to be a marine biologist, and I had a career in science, and it took all 4 years to really realize that what I wanted to do was swim with whales and then come out and extol their graces, and I didn't really want to be as I talked to Amory about, a sea urchin dissector. You know, not really saying anything bad, but I didn't have the temperament. Mm-hmm. And so luckily I had studied art and writing along with my environmental science. And after school, I was a little more clear that it was something creative that I wanted to do. And I decided to just get as much many different kinds of experiences as I could. So I ended up working at a nature center and being crew on a sailboat on the Alabama coast after college, and then waiting tables in Boston, and working at my first kayak shop, Rutabaga, in Madison, Wisconsin. And it was there in my early 20s that I just realized probably the reason I thought I was going to be a scientist is I took most of the inspiration for a lot of my life from the natural world. And Madison's a great town, but it was too citified for me, and mm-hmm. I ended up moving up to a friend's, my college roommate's parents had a little 8x12 shack near Empire, mm-hmm. and they said, you can just go and write and read and have a throw-like time and not meet anyone. And within a week, I had met just incredible people and my future husband. And so everything went out the window in terms of what I thought I was doing. But it was the best blessing because it was a really good place to kind of settle into an inspired landscape. And it really serves me, both the marriage to my husband, and we have now a 4-year-old daughter. And I find that it's just really easy to write here and find time for painting. And
so would you tell us about the collection and then perhaps read from one of those stories?
Sure. These are two short stories written over the course of about 6 years. One is older. The one I'm going to read, I started writing about 6 years ago, and it's been through several incarnations since then. It's not about anybody I know. It's not based on anything real, except that it does deal with the loss of a beloved person in your life. And I know that came from my best friend died in 1998 of cancer. Mm-hmm. And I've found that much of the fiction I've written since then has been, I'm sure, my attempt to just explore those feelings and wrap my mind around her loss. And fiction seems to be good at that.
It's such an interesting story because your writing comes through, but your artistic eye is so completely in that story.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think I had just really gotten into oil painting at that time, and it seemed like something I actually, that fit this character and fit what she needed to do.
Okay, so the story is called, and you're going to...
Okay, the story is called Walking Barefoot, and I'm going to read the first section of it at least. Ollie, the farmhouse floorboards creaked. The window pane shuddered in its casing. Georgie Newhouse, 5 years old, heard the hiss of something soft moving across the floor. A lemon moon lit part of the room and cast the rest in deep shadow. He peeked above the covers for a second, saw nothing, but was not reassured. Ollie, he said again. There was no reply. Whatever or whoever he'd heard near his bed was not interested in talking with him. He was sleeping in Ollie's room. Ollie, the cousin he remembered only as a blur of legs and red hair, as a calloused, dirty hand holding out a leopard frog by the pond one summer day. Look, Georgie. Ollie was dead. Everybody said so. You're dead, Georgie said to the room. You're dead, Ollie. The wind quieted down. The room filled itself up with moonlight. Despite his fear, Georgie felt his eyelids droop. He fell asleep imagining Ollie lying pale and cold on the trundle mattress underneath his old bed. Ollie was angry with Georgie for sleeping above him and for being alive. Elaine was up and out of the house before anyone besides her father was awake, and he had long since been working in the fields. Although the morning was warm, the dew on the rough grass made her bare feet shiver. She walked onto the gravel of the driveway, testing her calluses. Not bad for June, she decided, but she would have to toughen up before she could run at full speed without her shoes. She was far ahead of her citified little cousin Georgie, though, who was up visiting from Chicago with his mom, her Aunt Therese, and she intended to stay ahead. She needed to scout the fields and forests around the house for this day's bounty. By the time Georgie was awake, she'd know exactly where to take him. Her brother Ollie used to be the expedition leader, although she doubted he'd ever done any scouting ahead of time. His senses had been keener than hers, and he always seemed to know exactly where to look. He'd stop at a sound she couldn't hear, and look up to find a hawk on the branch eating its kill. He'd make her walk so softly they'd be able to follow a fox along the roadbed, and watch for long, slow minutes until it leapt straight up and pounced down into the grass to catch a field mouse. Ollie had never fought with her or abandoned her. He'd only laughed at her clumsiness and her tendency to speak too loudly at the wrong moment. Little Bird, he used to call her. His sister, Little Bird. Now, sometimes, she thought she felt his hand on her shoulder when she was walking alone. Once she thought she heard him say, "Shh, Lainey," and she looked up to see a doe standing, staring back at her. She never felt him in the house. There was an emptiness there much heavier than the weight of her missing brother. Home had changed in a way that said he was really gone, gone forever, and that maybe they were the ones who died, not Ollie. Maybe he was alive somewhere, and they had all died in that crash, and just didn't know it yet. She walked to the pond where a few frogs still chirruped after the carousing opus of the previous night. She felt the ground soften to sun-warmed mud beneath her feet as she stepped closer to the water and out from under the canopy into the light.
Wow. Thank you.
Sure.
It's a wonderful story. I've had a chance to read it three times, and my admiration for it grows every time I read it. It's such a strong story.
Oh, thank you for that, Aaron.
Jamie.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So Jamie is the second graduate of the Interlochen Arts Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
What did you do after Interlochen? Well, first of all, you grew up in this area.
Yes. Yep. I've grown up in northern Michigan, was a student at Interlochen. And then I went to Bennington College.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to study poetry there. I actually went hoping that I would be able to study with Mary Oliver,
mm-hmm.
who's always been a great inspiration. And she kind of disappeared off into the woods as soon as I got there. She took off. So that didn't happen when I was there. It was an interesting shift that sort of happened for me when I went to study at Bennington. How do I put it? Gosh, I guess really, I took quite a break from writing, and got very involved with theater, with acting and directing. And I think that there was almost an attempt to kind of step away from myself a little bit, kind of mm-hmm. from that intimate work of writing poems and thinking maybe I could make a clean break from it. It didn't work. It didn't work at all. I sort of found that without that process of taking in the world and kind of letting it stir and then giving it back, giving it back in words,
mm-hmm.
I really lost my connection with the world in a way and felt pretty disoriented. And so once I graduated from Bennington, I really started to kind of get back into this work of writing. And we'll be going to U of M in the fall in their MFA poetry program. So that's sort of been the
yes.
process. Thank
Great.
You. Thank you.
So a few years between undergraduate school
mm-hmm.
and graduate school,
mm-hmm.
and you have been writing and teaching writing and
mm-hmm.
working at it.
Yes.
And this collection is called?
Point of Sand.
Okay.
Point of Sand. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a good place to start.
That is a wonderful poem.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much. I have to find it in here.
It's about the fourth poem in.
Is it? Okay, let me see.
I couldn't figure out why it wasn't the first poem in the collection because it's stunning and it goes with the title.
Oh, thank you. And Point of Sand is actually, it's explained in the poem, but I think a lot of the work is very inspired by a sense of place,
mm-hmm.
Largely northern Michigan and Little Cayman Island. Two places that I'm always returning to or trying to return to. So this is called Looking Back, Point of Sand. When she thought of the island, she pictured pure white birds etched against pale sand, the shadows of bonefish moving like silhouettes through the afternoon, and always the east end, point of sand where she and the boy had walked all evening along one of the last wild coastlines. She thought, too, of the Caribbean salt, the scent of wind it left on her skin, the beads of it she found in her palms each morning, the incredible thirst she felt after their swims when the salt began to dissolve on her lips, the coconut he cracked open for her and the sweet milk they drank. She thought of the island, of the dirt runway and the nearby field where the locals played soccer in their bare feet, of the small cabin and the light reflecting off the water through their window, and she thought of him. How carefully he pulled the splinter of palm bark from the soft skin of her wrist, then shifted his eyes politely away when the strap of her dress fell below her breast, the gentle, slow humidity which took the place of words, those silences she had lived in so easily.
Mm. Thank you.
Mm. So there's an island poem. let's see here. This is actually from a series of poems that I'm working on right now, inspired by Chagall paintings.
Mm-hmm.
for Chagall. So this is the first in the series that I've been working on now. I don't know what wild secret berries you rubbed across the lids of your eyes, or if, in sleep, your lover fed you bits of feathers and the silver scales of fish from river pools at twilight, but somewhere there's a story. One day you looked out a window in Vitebsk or St. Petersburg or Paris, and the first figure lifted from the ground grew wings. I have never seen a man with the head of a goat cradle a woman in his arms, or a horse serenade two lovers, her dress falling just below her breasts, their lips the same shade of dark, sweet red. I have never seen these things, but there were days in the thick of love when I could have sworn my legs had floated out from under me, days I'm sure the fish traded its fins for wings and drifted in a perfect sky somewhere above my head.
Nice.
Wonderful poem.
So, oh, thanks.
Captures the characteristics of Chagall very nicely.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Since I've talked about Mary Oliver, maybe I'll read a Mary Oliver poem, which is one of the poems going back quite a ways, which was wonderful to get some feedback on in this process, because I felt I was kind of able to bring some new life into it with the comments and feedback that I was given during this kind of revision process. So this is On Meeting Mary Oliver in My Sleep. and it begins with a line from one of her poems, Some Herons, the long, sweet day lay before them. Wake up, you said to me. You have been sleeping for so long. We were lying in a river, the water beneath our backs, a current of sheets caught in the wind, and when I opened my eyes, the sky was turning circles around us. You placed the tip of your finger on my lips and told me to drink. This, you said, as my mouth filled with wild honey and plums and cool water, this is the taste of waking up. And then, while the day watched, we danced, drunk on the sweetness and whatever else was offered up to us.
Lovely. So how many years are covered in this chapbook? How many years of your writing?
Probably about 10 years.
About 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Starting around 16. So that was something I was a little
nervous
about.
I see Teresa nodding too.
Really?
That's interesting. I think mm-hmm. my first book took 10 years too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's 30 to 40 pages, but it's not 3 weeks of jamming.
Right.
Would you like to read another one?
Oh, how are you? Okay,
we
sure.
We are okay on
I'd
time.
I'd be happy to. Let's see. What to end
that's
with?
A nice
oh, okay.
We're all picking our favorites.
This is called A Stirring. I lived in Los Angeles for a very short period of time, and then hightailed it back to Northern Michigan pretty quickly. But I was a nanny when I was out there, and this is about a little boy who I watched, who was just wonderful. For Carter, age 2. All afternoon I watch you chase birds, pigeons, hawks, mourning doves, a field full of crows whose sudden flight at the sound of your small feet leaves you lost in their smoky trail. You stare until a stirring from some other stretch of land catches your eye, the gentle rustling of birds, and then, just as quickly, you run off towards them. From this distance, if I reduce everything to color and motion, you might be a tropical kingfisher, pale yellow feathers and dark eyes chasing after the larger birds. When the sun has set and every last bird flown away, you begin to cry. I try to explain that to be where they are, you must move softly, and imagine your way into the lives of trees and grass, must turn your body into a Pacific breeze. Later, when I sit with you at the base of a blue oak, and we listen together to the sounds of birds growing quiet, I feel your thoughts unwind, grow quiet with them. All the way home, your sleeping weight in my arms lifts up and up and up.
Wonderful.
I love the end of that poem.
Me too. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
So the three of you will be reading from your chapbooks April 2nd at Writing House at 7:30. And your books will be available at the reading and at the Michigan Writers website.
Yes.
And Horizon Books.
Yes.
And from the writers.
Yes.
Ah. Mm-hmm. So we hope that a large number of the listeners will come and hear you read. Thank you for being here.
Congratulations to all three of you.
Thank you so much.
It's a beautiful accomplishment. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Julie Case is currently the writer-in-residence at the Interlochen Arts Academy. A native of Benzie County, she earned her MFA in creative writing at the Rainier Writing Workshop at Pacific Lutheran University and is an alumna of the Interlochen Arts Academy and Arizona State University. When not at Interlochen, she makes her home in Seattle. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you very much.
And you've brought several things to read.
I've brought several things to read. I've been working on a lot of stuff while I've been here.
Good. Yeah. So we're going to start with a short story?
We'll start with a short story.
Okay. And it's called?
This is called Barn. And this is one piece that I've written since during my time at Interlochen.
And is this set?
Up here somewhere.
Up here somewhere. Okay.
You know, the general area.
I know the place exactly.
Actually, I will say it's interesting. There are a couple of barns in this story, and one of them I drove by the other day and realized it was in the condition that it was in my memory as well. So. Barn. The barn was bored by drafts. It would not stand another winter. Overhead, light leaked through holes in the ceiling. Beyond that, the rust-painted tin roof poured red streaks down the building's wooden sides. In the corner, the wood stove roared, and he thought of her at home, before his fire. He thought of her next to his kiln. He thought of her in a torrent of sheets, her back bowed, her skin rising white as moon against the pale sheets she slumbered upon. He gripped the hammer and brought it down again, missing his fingers, as he always did. Pneumatic, that was what the barn was. Rheumatic, some days. Hardly more than cardboard, the walls achingly thin. It hadn't always been that way. When his grandfather raised it, the thing had seemed worthy of something, practically a cause among the surrounding neighbors and farms. Now few such homesteads remained. What was left of Smitty's place was little more than farmhouse and sugar shack. What was barn, no more than stub of foundation. Farther down the road, the Wilson place had long since given itself over to ill-tended field, the sisters little minding it after the father and brother were gone. Last time he'd been in there was to buy the old Valiant, for which he'd paid a price so low as to almost seem shameful, though by then neither of the old maids drove. Now they were long since dead, the barn coming down within a year of the last of them. Miss Hattie Wilson, she'd held out longest, if he remembered right. So his barn was what remained. It would be the last to go. Though town had creeped up to what seemed an indecent nearness, it had not reached the barn, and the walls had stood. 70? 80 years? Jared himself had replaced the roof, what, 10 years ago? He counted backward toward that day, remembering it anew for the first time in what seemed like ages. How the light had found them together. How he had pulled her hips to his as they stood under the tree, staring at the work he had done. 20, not 10. More than 20 years had gone by then. He squinted upward to where a starling fluttered in the rafters, where it had made a nest on the hand-hewn beam. Once upon a time, there'd been cats here. Once upon a time, the starlings wouldn't have dared make a home above his head. Now, the cats were gone, and the field mice and birds invaded the space, though he little minded. She'd gone with them, following the girl. He squinted at the memory of her head above the Valiant's vinyl seats, her furled brow a bare reflection in the speckled mirror. She had not even turned to wave him goodbye. He brought the hammer down again. It echoed in the room. His stomach rolled. How long since he'd eaten? He didn't even know. Certainly that day. Certainly he had eaten that day. Something with his coffee, yes? He glanced at his shirt. He knew, sometimes, fastidious as he tried to be, he spilled. He was impatient now. Impatient to get on with things. Impatient to get to the barn before it fell down around him. He had loved since her, it was true, though never in the same way. Always something escaped him, as if he recoiled a bit at the thought of other arms, other hearts. Still, he was a man, and he had loved since then, had spent sweat-filled nights with other women, had woken to wrap his arms around them, had woken to the smell of coffee and bacon. He had tried to love since her, had tried to give more than just his body, though always the depth of it escaped him, and he found himself apologizing for this. Contrite as he backed out the door, wanting to apologize to the room, to the view, to the dog, looking at him with regret. Scarcely had they asked for his remorse, and maybe it was because he had, somehow, always chosen those who didn't expect him to stay. Perhaps it was relief for them, too, the release of burden, the way the sky opened up overhead afterward. Even now with Libby it was different, though for 3 years they'd been together, if that was what it was called. Him going across the street to her house a couple of nights a week and most Sundays. Him working in her garage, fixing the things she'd broken since last time. Or them just sitting together over a deep stew, whiskey in his coffee. Some nights he stayed. Some nights he held her. Some nights her fingers curled in the hairs of his chest. Even now, at almost 70. Not that old, her daughter might say, if she knew the details, though he felt differently. Not like Maddie, though. Never since. If he always remembered her scent, well, that was a thing. And he did always remember it. Some mix of oatmeal and fresh-cut bough, her sweat tinged sharp like wet batteries. The space between her legs a smell as dark as molasses, but none so sweet. Even now, the moments he'd spent there, her face alight above him, nearly drove him to his knees. And now, an old man without her, her only presence in his life, the memory. The memory, and, further beyond the barn, down the path marked by his footsteps alone, the peeling birch bark, birch tree, the peeling birch tree, and the small grave, no bigger than a pillow below it. Him, the only one to know it now. Him, the last to visit. He'd made the casket out of wood he'd felled himself. A morning's work, taking the tree down by hand. A day's work, carving the big oak beam, then shaping the remains into pieces. A night's work, soldering the boards into place. Always the salt rising in his eyes. Her in the kitchen, her in the bedroom, her pacing the house, wringing her hands. Them, not knowing she was next to leave. Overhead, the timber sagged, the starling squalled, the roof dripped spotted light upon him. The barn was coming down. It would not hold the winter.
Thank you very much. Lovely.
Thank you.
And you have a poem for us.
I have a poem, a short poem. This is entitled Small Enough. The apple is like love, you think, then, fingertips brushing thighs, stop yourself from smiling. You imagine the crunch of skin rupturing, the coolness of clear juice against the throat. Still, your stomach turns at the idea of all that white flesh. You cannot have it. Your mind races against the thought, and so you stare at rows of meat, graze with your eyes, pyramids of carrots. Behind a glass window, a gloss of dressing rests on broccoli. Sesame seeds accessorize deep leafy greens. Nearby, bushels of pears beckon. Eat. Eat something, your mind implores. Please, we're starving, your heart bleats. Yes, you think, I know. your hands curl, your fist stuffs its way into your mouth, your stomach no longer rumbles, no longer protests, is silent in its sorrow, and still you cannot find a sandwich small enough, cannot locate a naked green, an unadulterated omelet, nowhere between the potatoes and pies, among the salads and star fruit, amid the artichokes and apples, can you find a single morsel which will not ripen against you?
Lovely. Thank you so much. Julie Case, who is the writer in residence at the Interlochen Arts Academy. And Julie, you have a rather spectacular website.
Thank you very much.
And tell our listeners how they can find it.
It's pretty easy. It's www.juliehcase.com.
Okay. And you have some podcasts and some other things available through
that?
Yeah,
I work with an organization called A River and Sound Review, and it started off as, we like to call it, a literary variety show. And I've had the luck of being recorded both in the live show and on their podcast. It's also launching into a new genre, literary magazine, online literary magazine, to start coming out next year.
Okay, and people can find that going through your website.
You can find it going through my website, yes.
Great. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now we have our regular segment on poetry from Fleeta Brown, the former poet laureate of Delaware who now lives in Traverse City. We've asked Fleeta to offer her thoughts and comments as a contributing guest of this program.
The real case for poetry. Whatever small part of the news that's devoted to poetry generally claims, sort of vaguely, that poetry's good for us. Our culture still lugs on its back the heavy duffel bag of Puritanism, and when well-meaning people, me among them, look for a way to promote the arts, we nearly always find ourselves making a case for their usefulness. Recently, a college president was reported to have said, apparently in all seriousness, that he did indeed support the arts because they're useful to give people something to talk about at cocktail parties. Even the academic world is a business these days, and business runs on efficacy and efficiency. It appears that the only way the arts can get a hearing is by jumping on that bandwagon. And after all, when the walls of our past educational kingdom are crumbling, when even basic skills such as math and reading are failing to take, when money's short and classes are large, practicality is forced upon us. When people come home from work, stare wearily at TV for a few minutes, and fall into bed, to argue that they should stop to read a poem seems like an argument for using an outhouse instead of a bathroom. Inconvenient, awkward, and slower to get to. It's no wonder we keep looking for ways in which poetry's good for you. People can be dragged out of bed sometimes at dawn to go for a run if they feel it's good for them. Maybe they can be dragged to the page to read a poem. Even play itself has been dissected and made useful. David Elkind, in his book called The Power of Play, says, although work and play are thought to be in opposition to one another, they in fact complement one another. Any endeavor is more effective when all three drives are operative. Effective. He goes on to explain how businesses run better, workers have a more positive attitude, and children learn better given ample time for self-initiated play. I can't argue with that, but it does seem sad to me that even what we choose to do, our kicking around time, has been co-opted by usefulness. For most of us, the very definition of kicking around, of play, is that for a few minutes we're free of what we ought to do. It's wonderful that our schools are beginning to take seriously the need to include more poetry in the curriculum. Poetry is showing up in various ways on standardized tests, and some teachers are getting quite good at teaching it. They know that studying poetry can enhance reading skills, promote precise use of language, help students express feelings, and encourage flexibility of mind, all skills that can carry over into a useful and productive life. The newly rich Poetry Foundation, based in Chicago, is pumping hundreds of thousands of dollars into making poetry more visible and more accessible to the mainstream. And thank goodness for Ruth Lilly, whose endowment made that possible. I rejoice every time a poet is featured on the Lehrer NewsHour, courtesy, in part, of the Poetry Foundation. So, why am I a tad bit uneasy? Like all art, poetry arises and flourishes as play. Real play is what you do when the grown-ups' backs are turned. If they watch you and tell you to stack the blocks this way instead of that way, it takes the fun out of it. Art is first of all fun. It's not first of all useful. Fun requires free time, a sense of having all the time in the world. That may be why people often drink when they're at play. It seems to slow time down. A poem is exasperatingly slow. It must be written within that all the time in the world space. It demands to be read in the same way. Now, here I could launch into all the reasons that slowness is good for us, but instead I'd like to describe a poem as a deeply private play, one that reaches blindly into the unknown, defying all demands for efficiency. If your parents tell you it's time to put your shoes on, you dawdle and keep fooling around with your Legos. You may be late, you little iconoclast, but you're having a good time being alive right at that moment.
Thank you for joining us this month on Michigan Writers on the Air. I want to thank our guests on today's program. Also, my thanks to Fleeta Brown, Interlochen Public Radio, and Michigan Writers, Inc. Check out the Michigan Writers website at www.mishwriters.org for an updated list of workshops and activities. And a reminder again that the authors of the 2009 chapbook competition will be reading this Thursday, April 2nd, at Writing House on the Interlochen campus at 7:30 p.m. My gratitude to our production crew here at IPR Radio, Peter, Jack, Brock, and Brad, and to the Neptune Quartet for our lively theme music. Be sure to listen next month to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio 91.5. The show airs the fourth Saturday of the month at 7 p.m., repeating on Sunday at 1 p.m. Until then, we wish you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.